It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Neil Conan is away. I'm Guy Raz. For the next few days, I'll be keeping this chair warm to give Neil some much-deserved time off. I hope you'll bear with me as I make my way through the clocks and buttons here in Studio 3A. Today, we're going to be talking about America divided. Not just red state and blue state America, but increasingly red and blue neighborhoods. These are places where folks tend to vote the same way and share the same social and political values. It's a phenomenon reporter Bill Bishop calls the Big Sort, the sorting of Americans into like-minded communities. Now, Bill Bishop has just published a book called The Big Sort. He's our guest for part of this hour. And he joins us from member station KUT in Austin. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Guy.
Now, Bill, before we get into the conversation, I was hoping you could read a brief passage from the book, the part where you describe how you and your wife chose to move to the neighborhood in Austin where you now live.
Oh, yeah, we came and my wife drew some little smiley faces on the neighborhoods where we felt comfortable. So this is the part from the book. We didn't intend to move into a community filled with Democrats, but that's what we did, effortlessly and without a trace of understanding about what we were doing. We bought a house on one of those smiley-faced streets, a shady neighborhood of dog walkers, Jane Jacobs-approved front porches, bright paint, bowling ball yard art, and you keep believing, we'll keep evolving bumper stickers. In 2000, George W. Bush, then the governor of Texas, took 60% of the state's vote. But in our patch of Austin, Bush came in third, behind both Al Gore and Ralph Nader. 4 years later, 8 out of 10 of our neighbors voted for John Kerry.
Bill Bishop is our guest for most of the hour. We'd like to hear from you, our listeners, as well. Are you part of the Big Sort? Be honest with us. Have you made choices to live in a place where most people share your political values and your lifestyle? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. You can also write about your experiences on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, the opinion pages and the legacy of Jesse Helms. But first, the Big Sort. Bill Bishop is our guest. And Bill Bishop, in the 1976 presidential race, about a quarter, 1 out of 4 Americans, lived in a community that handed a landslide victory to either Gerald Ford or to Jimmy Carter. Now, by 2004, half of Americans, 1 out of 2 Americans, lived in a county that handed a landslide victory to George Bush or John Kerry. What does that tell us about the way Americans are sorting themselves out?
Well, it's really a fascinating phenomenon that Robert Cushing, the statistician I work with, discovered, and it goes even further than that. I mean, 60% of U.S. counties haven't changed their presidential allegiance since before 1988, and what it told us, especially when we looked at how the entire of society was changing, was that people were finding their lives within smaller and more isolated and more like-minded communities. And we don't think that people were looking around to be next to someone who agreed with them about single-payer health plans or Iraq policy. They were looking to be around those who were like themselves. And when you do that in our politics today, you end up being around people who vote the same way that you vote.
And we'll talk more about some of those anecdotes. But Bill Bishop, how do we know that the Big Sort is really happening now, that people are moving to neighborhoods with like-minded folks?
Well, we can count. You know, there is no polling that asks people their political designation and also where they lived 5 years earlier. But we can look at where people move, and we can see that 70% of the people who left red counties, solidly red counties in the last 15 years, moved to other red counties. And
in other words, conservatives moving to conservative counties.
People from conservative places, by and large, move to other conservative places. And we can see that states that change become more purple, like Colorado, had huge influxes of people from blue counties. So the largest contributor of people to Colorado since the early 1990s was outside of the state, was L.A. County, California.
But you're not seeing this just at a statewide level. I mean, you're seeing this in neighborhoods, communities, really small, micro-targeted areas.
Right, and we're seeing it across the board. You see it within churches. Churches since the mid-1970s have been constructed around what's called in church growth circles the homogeneous unit principle, that churches grow faster if they design their services and their amenities and the preacher dresses like those a target audience that comes into the church. And so my favorite example is one in Austin where there is a church, Presbyterian church, where George Bush went to church, and also where the current Republican governor goes to church.
Rick Perry.
And then just a few miles away, Rick Perry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, big organ and handle, you know, coming in when the service begins. And just a few miles away, there's another Presbyterian church where when I went, the opening hymn was by Sting. and the preacher talked about female mystics from the Middle Ages, and that week there was a workshop on Wiccans, and
the governors didn't show up in those churches.
I don't think the governor knew that those places. And the funny thing is, people don't even know that these places exist. The thought of going to a church different from the one that you attend is just you just can't understand it. So people in my neighborhood can't imagine going to a church festival, say, in a small town 40 or 50 miles away. And it's that's why the subtitle is that the Big Sword is tearing us apart. And what it really is isolating us in a way that's destructive.
And before I ask you about why it's tearing us apart, I want to ask you about this idea that it seems logical. I mean, what's so bad about it? I mean, people logically want to live around those who are most like them.
And yeah, birds flock,
right.
And people don't marry those who are unlike themselves. They marry people exactly like themselves. What struck us was that this was increasing. Not that people would find comfort around others like themselves. That's a natural human reaction, but that the numbers would be increasing, and that it would be happening across the board in churches, in clubs, in volunteer groups, and in neighborhoods. So why we think it's happening because people find comfort within in a strange and often troublesome world. People have shrunk their lives to the size of their communities,
But what's the problem with that? I mean, what are the consequences of it?
The consequences are we have incredible diversity within the country. We have Odessa, Texas, is able to have a high school course on the Bible. Philadelphia, meanwhile, recently cut off their subsidy to the Boy Scouts because of the Boy Scouts' position on homosexuality. And so people have this is the good part, you have this incredible choice about where and how to live. What happens nationally is that these different groups have no connection to one another, and it makes it almost impossible for the country to come together on any kind of consensus on anything. Mm-hmm. And as congressmen and women begin to represent these increasingly like-minded districts, it just makes it difficult for them to compromise. The parties have become polarized, and so things break down on a national basis where they might move ahead locally.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Steve is on the line from Kentwood, Michigan. Steve, go ahead.
Hello?
Hi. Is that Steve?
Actually, no, it's not. It's Carlene from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hi, Carlene. Go ahead.
All right.
Sorry about
Hi.
That.
That's okay. Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I actually was born and raised in Southern California, and I went to inner city schools, and I grew up in the 90s, and a lot of the schools I went to had moratoriums on the level of, ethnicities. And I moved to Kansas City with my fiancé for work, and not knowing the area, we actually ended up moving to a pretty conservative area, and right now we're actually looking to move more towards the city. And it's really interesting because where I teach in the city is 98% black school, and I grew up in a setting in the inner city where it was very diverse, and I saw the benefits of that, whereas people here, you see, the schools are a majority of either a certain religious preference, like you said, or a certain ethnic base. Mm. And I see how it's actually breaking them down because they're not able to see other ways of thinking, and you almost get caught up in your own way of doing things instead of seeing outside the box. And I have loved being able to move around. I went to college in Arizona, and I've always said to my family that I think people on the West Coast, especially in, you know, more affluent areas, should move to middle America
and
where the rest of the world lives.
And what do you look for when you move to a new neighborhood? I mean, what are you looking for, specific things aside from good schools? I mean, do you look for people who have certain political stickers on their cars, certain kind of cars?
Sure. You know what? The big thing for us, for me and my fiance, is we look for simple things, and this sounds really crazy, but manicured lawns, sidewalks. I know this sounds crazy, but we really look at, you know, the types of cars that are in the driveway. If there's a big giant pickup truck, you know, or a big tractor trailer, we look at people who care about their property. We look at people, you know, and not necessarily, it's great to have political ideology that's the same, but more, in fact, of the same values. And how about we, you know, we care about the same types of things.
How would you describe those values?
Taking care of personal property. And, you know, our thing is we like to go out and walk around, and we value whatever money we put into wherever we're going to buy. And I know a lot of places is very different. We come from, you know, part of the country where communities are master planned quite often, where you go to, like, Middle America, or you go to, like, the Northwest, where my parents retired, and they look at master planned communities as a sign of, like, the Californians that are, you know, have gone crazy, like the concrete village. And whereas for us, we see it as a sign of kind of uniformity and a way to all come together and be more mobile. Mm-hmm. And so it really, I like it because it, to me, it offers a way to get to know people better. But I definitely am one of those people where I like to see a lot of diversity. Mm-hmm. But it does, as we're in our mid to late 20s, it really helps when we're around people that are, you know, of the same age.
Well, thanks so much for the call. Karen, is it?
It's actually Kylie.
Kylie, thanks so much for the call. The book is titled The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. More with Bill Bishop in a moment. We'll ask him, what do we do about it? How do we unsort America? Our number, 800-989-8255. I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Guy Raz here in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the big sort. That's what Bill Bishop calls the phenomenon of clustering in America. More and more people live in areas where their neighbors are an awful lot like them in terms of their politics and their values and their beliefs. And this clustering, he argues, is tearing the country apart. Bill Bishop is with us this hour. You can read an excerpt from his book, The Big Sort, on our website. That's at npr.org. Are you part of The Big Sort? Be honest with us. What choices have you made to live in a place where most people share your political values and your lifestyle? Our number, 800-989-8255. Email us at talk@npr.org. And you can also share your experiences with us on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. Bill Bishop, when did this all begin, this big sort phenomenon that you describe?
Well, we think it began in the mid-1970s. Actually, we think it began earlier than that, in the mid-1960s, when the old structures of society kind of came apart. People began to drop out of those clubs that Robert Putnam has written about. Bowling leagues peaked in the mid-1960s. Also peaking in the mid-1960s was church membership in traditional denominations. After the 1965, people began to withdraw from those Presbyterian churches and Lutheran churches and Presbyterian churches, and divorce rates began to climb, and newspaper penetration began to decline. And also in the mid-1960s, people began to lose trust in government. Mm-hmm. And as all those structures began to crumble, when society came back together again in the 1970s, it was on a more local, more personal basis. It was based more on a politics of self-expression rather than economics. And so I think we're looking at a 30-year process here.
I want to read an email question now from Alan in New Brighton, Minnesota. He asks, are people sorting themselves out, or are the politicians simply rearranging the districts, in other words, gerrymandering, which creates the impression of a big sort?
Right. We looked at counties. So counties did not change boundaries. But there is a debate on gerrymandering, and I think most political scientists have concluded, although most journalists have not concluded the same thing, is that gerrymandering has not led to an increase in like-minded districts. Districts have become more like-minded over the years, but gerrymandering is not the cause. The cause is places becoming increasingly like-minded, and it happens at every level of geography. States, in 1976, the average difference between Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter at the state level was about 8 points. By 2004, it was over 14 percentage points. Mm-hmm. And so we always want to blame someone else for our troubles, but this is something really that we've created.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller. We've got Keith on the line from Grand Junction, Colorado. Keith, go ahead.
I was actually calling because I kind of live in a conservative little area in Colorado, and my wife and I are trying to purchase a house right now, and we keep looking all around, and one of the things that we keep saying to each other over and over again is the fact that we have to get out of this conservative little hole that we live in. And I don't really foresee a lot of, negativity coming out of that. I know that part of what you were saying was that it was ripping the country apart, but I think people get much, much, much more comfortable when they're surrounded by a political view that they're comfortable with, and we're both kind of in a position where neither one of us feel real comfortable talking politics or anything like that in our workplaces or any of those kinds of things, because most of the folks around here do not hold our beliefs.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point, Bill Bishop, Keith raises. He says he feels more comfortable talking to people who think like he thinks. Isn't that normal?
Yes, and this is the phenomenon. Political scientists have known for the past 50 years that political minorities in heavily majority districts vote less. David Campbell at Notre Dame has found that they actually are less likely to participate in community events or community projects. And people do exactly as Keith described, as they withdraw. They keep their mouth shut. They don't talk up at book club or at Rotary at noon. And that's a problem. It really does happen, exactly as Keith described.
And you describe in your book, Bill Bishop, how this phenomenon actually creates kind of political extremism. The moderation.
On the opposite side, what happens is that like-minded groups over time become more extreme in the way they're like-minded. So one classic experiment had students in France who disliked the United States were put into a room and asked to talk about America, and 2 hours later they come out and they dislike America more. And so as communities, as neighborhoods become more like-minded, they become more extreme. So in my neighborhood, it's not enough to say I disagree with George Bush. It's that George Bush needs to be impeached. There needs to be a criminal investigation. You don't want to be mistaken for a Republican in a heavily Democratic area, so you move a little bit to the extreme, so you'll fit in.
Mm-hmm. Keith, thanks so much for the call.
Hey, thank you much for your time.
Bye. Let's take another call. Let's go to Esther. Esther is with us from Chicago. Esther?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. My question had to do with the way in which private religious schools accelerate that sense of a segmentation of society and teach children to only be comfortable with others who agree with them, both politically and in terms of religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Bishop, you talk a lot about religion and the church in your book. How does that factor in?
Well, this works. I think what Esther describes happens, but I think it happens in every group that is like-minded and homogenous. You're taught to be afraid of the other, or you're just afraid of the other. But what Esther describes is this process, this sorting process that's taken place over the last 30 or 40 years, which is that we've lost the middle of American society. We've lost the common school and the common church and the common meeting place in the neighborhood, and we replaced it with religious schools or with Montessori schools or with clubs that are more ideologically pointed. And this is sort of the general phenomenon, and she describes the general result.
Esther, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Bill Bishop, there's a fascinating graph in the book, The Big Sort, and it shows how members of Congress who have been described as moderates have decreased dramatically since the 1948 congressional session. 2005, only about 10% of members of the House of Representatives classified as moderates. Is that in a sense a symptom or an outcome of the Big Sort?
That's a reflection of the sort. As places become more homogenous, they elect more homogenous or more ideologically extreme representatives. And we saw it in 2006 and in elections before that. And so today, literally in Congress, these are things that Keith Poole at University of California, San Diego has put together. There is no Democrat who is more conservative than the most liberal Republican. There's literally no overlap in Congress between the two parties. And it just makes it tough for any decision to be made, for any compromise to be reached.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another caller. Lynn is on the line from San Antonio, Texas. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a couple of comments. I'm wondering if part of the thing is that politicians have appealed to the extremes to get elected. I'm a liberal who lives in a very conservative area, and I find that really on most issues, on many issues, there I can compromise. I can see, that we really feel that certain things are important or that we want the same thing. But it's gotten to the point where people can't talk to each other. And then the other thing is, do you think that people, when they're living near conservative people because of peer pressure, become more conservative?
Bill Bishop?
Well, I think conservatives as a group become more conservative if they are a group, and liberals become more liberal because of this process of group polarization that we talked about earlier. But I think, Lynn, it's interesting. Mixed company tends to moderate opinions, and Lynn obviously lives in a mixed kind of city south of here and or a neighborhood, and she has her view of things is that there are ways to compromise, and I think it's that kind of rubbing up. Democracy isn't supposed to be comfortable. We're not supposed to be always happy with the results. We're supposed to hear this constant clashing of opinion. And it's when we don't hear the differences that we get into trouble. And I think Lynn's example is one where it's something we should learn from.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, thanks so much for the call.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Bill, I want to ask you about the strange thing that we have. I mean, we have access to so much information, so many different ideas and opinions and media outlets and internet sites. And yet you say, by and large, fewer and fewer Americans are exposed to diverse and different viewpoints.
Yeah, especially people who've been to graduate school have the least diverse discussion mates when it comes to politics. It's people who have not graduated from high school who have the most diverse political lives in our country. But people do not, given a choice of reading material, people will pick the reading material on the net or a newspaper delivered at the door that agrees with them. It's even turned out that Democrats are increasingly less likely to listen to George Bush give his State of the Union address, that just as Republicans were growing not to hear, not to listen or tune in Bill Clinton when he gave his State of the Union address. We just don't want to hear opinions that disagree with us. It's just too uncomfortable.
Let me read an email from Steve in Madison, Wisconsin. He writes, I have lived in both red and blue states. Currently, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, which is considered a very liberal and progressive city. At first, I found Madison a comfort, the feeling of being amongst my people once more. However, I have become quite bored of the pretentious liberal homogeneity, separated in degrees by bumper sticker mentality. I'm looking forward to moving back to a red zone to work with the people seeking resistance to my ideas while suggesting my ideas a true challenge to me and them, where real ideas are born. Do you hear that from people?
I feel that sometimes myself. My wife and I used to own a weekly newspaper in a small Texas town, and we miss the diversity that we had in a town of 3,500 that we miss, that we don't have in a town of 1.7 million.
We are talking with Bill Bishop. He is the author of the new book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. He's at member station KUT in Austin. You can join the conversation as well by giving us a call. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call. Doug is on the line from McAllister in Oklahoma. Doug, go ahead.
Yes, I believe that our real cause for the separation, red state, blue state, is the way the media is the primary problem, I believe, because there is so much media avenues out there in order to gain an audience. You start segmenting your audience and catering to them, which reinforces, as you know, as you've mentioned, audiences do like to listen to what they believe in. So they're gravitating towards Fox, let's say, for the right, or MSNBC for the left, and it reinforces and emboldens our positions and our biases. And therefore, we become reluctant to negotiate terms because we believe so strongly in this by being reinforced through the media. And I like to hear whether or not you believe in that. If we just had two soft drinks, we would say nothing, as an example. Coke is a real thing, as an example, or the Pepsi generation. But if you've got a lot of competition, it's just a natural thing to find you're an audience and keep them and cater to them. And that has caused this big rift in our country.
Doug, thanks so much for the comment.
Good description, Doug. I mean, essentially what he's saying is that our political life is taken on the color of our commercial life, where we have 50 different kinds of hamburger helper and we get exactly the kind of product that we want. And I think that's exactly right. In the 2004 campaign, the Bush campaign was really brilliant in applying these kind of micro-targeting and techniques that had been used in the commercial world for decades to be able to deliver a message specifically to a person, deliver the message a person wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And I thought after that campaign there'd be a revolt. You know, the people would say, no, you know, democracy is supposed to be about persuasion. It's supposed to be about two sides debating issues and people making choices out of the result of that debate. And instead, what we have is, I mean, left-wing bloggers and Karl Rove agree that we need candidates adept at micro-targeting and segmentation and all those other kinds of marketing techniques that Doug described that really tend to separate and polarize us.
Bill Bishop, if the Big Sort contributes to increasing extremism in America, how do we get out of it? How do we undo it? How do we unsort? What's the prescription to change this trend?
Well, a couple of things can and will eventually happen. I mean, right now, all our issues are so lined up. There was a really interesting county commissioner in Oregon who told me that the anti-abortion people in his state no longer ask him about abortion. They ask him about property rights because they know that his answer about property rights will foretell what he thinks about abortion. And what we have are all these issues that are all lined up with party. And so what we need are issues that arise that don't have a home within the party. And that hasn't happened yet. But it will. That's how classically these things begin to disassemble. And the other thing that I think is going to happen is that another generation is coming up that is not all that happy with our boomer notions of right and wrong and left and right. And I spent a lot of time with kids in the emerging church, very biblically oriented churches, but not judgmental. These are kids that grew up in the mega churches and in the religious wars of the 1980s and 90s, and they're sick of it.
And not necessarily liberal or conservative.
No, both. And they're comfortable with difference, and they're comfortable with ambiguity. And I think that's what we need, is more comfort with ambiguity.
Bill Bishop is the author of the new book, The Big Sort, Why the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart. There's an excerpt of the book, from the book, rather, at npr.org. He joined us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Bill Bishop, it was a real pleasure having you.
God, thank you very much.
Coming up, how Jesse Helms made a difference in America. The talk of the Nation opinion page is next. I'm Guy Raz. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Former Senator Jesse Helms died on Friday in his home state of North Carolina. He was 86. Now, to his dying day, he was a man who energized the right and he infuriated the left. His hardline opposition to abortion funding, funding for AIDS research, the United Nations, affirmative action, and communism made him a hero to conservatives, but a caricature to liberals. His critics called him out of tune with the times, even a bigot and a racist. In 1990, Senator Helms ran for re-election against Harvey Gantt, the African-American mayor of Charlotte. Gantt, it seemed, had a shot. He was up in the polls. But that changed late in the campaign when Senator Helms ran this commercial.
You needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota. Is that really fair? Harvey Gantt says it is.
Now, Senator Helms stood by that ad, but was it racist? No, he said.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. What am I supposed to do? Ignore everything that involves a black man? That would make me speechless in this campaign. And Mr. Gantt knows how to dish it out, but he can't take it.
On the opinion page today, Wall Street Journal columnist John Fund joins us to remember Senator Jesse Helms, a man he calls the exemplar of modern conservatism. Now, we'd like to hear from you as well, especially listeners in North Carolina. Did you vote for Senator Helms? How will you remember him, as a hero or as a villain? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment at our blog. That's npr.org/blogofthenation. John Fund is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal. You can find his link, a link to his page, his piece, rather, How Jesse Helms Made a Difference, on our blog. And John Fund joins us by the phone from Aspen, Colorado. Thanks for your time today, sir.
Thanks, Mr. Ross. Just two quick corrections. My piece didn't run today. It ran Saturday.
Oh, thank you so much for the correction.
I didn't say that he was the exemplar of conservatism. I said Ronald Reagan represented the sunny and optimistic face, the uncompromisingly defiant and angry face. The exemplar was Jesse Helms.
Well, thanks for the clarification, and a fair one at that. Can you assess Jesse Helms' legacy, John Fund, you know, his achievements, without factoring in some of his more controversial views, particularly on the issue of civil rights?
Well, I factor in both his views on civil rights and gays, and I basically conclude they were myopic and blinkered. And his record is mixed. But your audience, in reading the obituaries, may not have picked up other parts of Jesse Helms for a fuller context. Who was the first senator to bring Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Soviet dissident, to America over the objections of the State Department? Who was the only senator to raise objections about Robert Mugabe's slaughter of 40,000 people with a North Korean-trained secret police brigade in 1984, which was 24 years ago, which was a sign to come of what Mugabe might be capable of? Who was the first senator to basically proclaim that Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary should join NATO? If you go through his career, there are all kinds of examples where Jesse Helms was ahead of his time. Who was the first senator to say the United Nations was corrupt and needed a full audit? This was years before the oil for food scandal. So there's a lot of parts of Jesse Helms' career that I think are to his credit, as well as the parts that I think are to on the negative side.
Mm-hmm. I mean, despite some of the more sort of controversial positions he took, even some of them that you've just mentioned, Jesse Helms really was a hero to many conservatives, somebody who in a sense, re-energized the party. And you write about how in 1976 he really relaunched Ronald Reagan's career.
In 1976, Reagan had lost five straight primaries to President Ford. He came to North Carolina's primary broke and under pressure to withdraw. Helms turned out his volunteer army for Reagan and raised money to put Reagan's 30-minute speech which was an updated version of his famous speech for Goldwater, on North Carolina television, and it scored an upset victory for Reagan. He went on to the convention. It kept his candidacy alive and made him the front runner for the 1980 nomination when he did run again and become president.
Mm-hmm. John Fund, let's go to the phone lines. We've got Tony on the air with us from Columbia, South Carolina. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Go ahead.
I can't be an apologist for Jesse Helms. I'm sorry. I grew up with the man, and his entire basis for his political career was out and out racism and bigotry. He was a follow up to George Wallace. I think he hurt the Republican Party and hurt American politics in general. And I'm sorry for his family, but I'm not sorry to see him go.
And John Fund, you wrote in your column that Senator Helms had a blind spot on racial issues. Is that a delicate way of saying he was a racist?
Well, let's be very careful here. A person's public stance and their private thoughts, I think, need to be weighed carefully. Sam Ervin, who was Helms' colleague in the Senate, was a Democrat and was the chief legal strategist for segregation. He basically drafted the Southern Manifesto arguing against Brown v. Board of Education on school integration. And Ervin, though, had a very varied career. He did a lot of things in his career about constitutional rights, privacy. He led the hearings in Watergate that brought Richard Nixon down. When he died, his career was put in full context. I'm simply arguing that Helms did have blind spots, but his career should not be viewed simply through the prism of one issue, where I think, privately, I think Jesse Helms has a case to make that he was not a bigot. And let me tell you why. He hired the first black radio announcer in North Carolina at his station. He had a completely integrated television station that he ran. He hired many blacks on his staff. He often, in his early career in the 50s and 60s, made insensitive comments. But so, too, did Senator Robert Byrd, who was a legal of the Ku Klux Klan, who sits in the Senate today, who voted against Thurman Marshall for the Supreme Court, the first black to be appointed to that position, and who just a few years ago used the N-word in a national television interview.
Tony, is that a fair point? Tony, you still with us? No, Tony's gone.
I'm simply saying, given the record of people like Ervin and Senator William Fulbright, who Bill Clinton worked for many months, who also strongly opposed the Civil Rights Act, Senator Al Gore Sr., Al Gore's father, who opposed the Civil Rights Act vociferously, many people from the South in those days have a checkered record. And I think Helms, over time, understood that that record was checkered. He didn't retreat from his positions, but I think he learned nuance, and I also think that he tried to make amends when he hooked up with Bono, the rock star, to provide increased AIDS funding for Africa and also to provide more foreign aid to Africa channeled through private sources rather than through corrupt government.
Let's talk about that in a moment, John Fund, but I want to ask you about this issue of rights for gay and lesbians. Here's Senator Helms in 1990. He gave a speech to his supporters kicking off his reelection campaign. Let's take a listen.
Seldom a day passes that there's not another lawmaker coming up with some new idea which would further destroy parental authority in our land. Just think about it. Homosexuals, lesbians, disgusting people marching in our streets demanding all sorts of things, including the right to marry each other and the right to adopt children. How do you like them apples?
John Fund, what do you make of comments on that?
Well, I'm from San Francisco. I think the reference to disgusting people is, of course, mean-spirited and bigoted. However, just remember, the public policy position that Senator Helms was endorsing, opposing same-sex marriage, was endorsed by 61% of Californians in a 2000 referendum or 1998 referendum, and today the polls show it might still lose by over 50% of the vote. So I think that, again, let's take this into context. If you go talk to Bono, and in fact I encourage you to interview him, he would say that Senator Helms mellowed in his later years, and the fact that he helped channel hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to fight AIDS in Africa is at least a partial positive part in his ledger, and you should perhaps note that as well as noting that speech.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a caller. We've got Dennis on the line from Rochester, New York. Dennis, welcome.
Hi. I wasn't a fan of Jesse Helms' politics, but the thing that I will give him is that he was an authentic politician. He always knew where he stood. He didn't say one thing and then did another. He was consistent. There was no ambiguity. There was no ambivalence about, you know, what he was going to think or say. and how he's going to practice his politics. And I think that in this day and age, and perhaps, you know, even in the past, is worth something. I didn't agree with him, you know, on all of, on most of his issues, but you always knew where he stood.
John Fund, a principled politician?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. He was principled.
One of the things that Helms brought to politics was you knew exactly how he was going to stand. He wasn't going to equivocate. He said, if you oppose me, try to defeat me in the next election, but I will always stand by certain values. Now, admittedly, even Helms, as stubborn as he was, did change. He started out as a critic of Israel. He ended up as a stalwart ally of Israel. I've described the shifts on both foreign aid to Africa and AIDS funding that he underwent. But in general, Jesse Helms remained the strong, principled conservative that he started out being towards the end of, all the way to the end of his life.
And I think that's really saying an awful lot for him, because that's like saying he grew in the job, so to speak. I don't want to say he was on a learning curve, but it was an evolutionary type thing, and times change, and he reacted to circumstances. And I think you have to give him that. But by giving him that, I don't think you, I think you, in fact, reinforce his authenticity.
William Safire in the New York Times wrote in the late 1990s that Helms had been the most successful bipartisan chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee since Arthur Vandenberg in the 1940s. He was not the monster that was trying to destroy the State Department that everyone thought he was going to be. Madeleine Albright, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, ended up being a warm friend of Jesse Helms, went down to speak at his alma mater. And if you interview her, she has many fond remembrances of how helpful he was on many issues.
Sure. Dennis, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to another caller. We've got Skip on the line. He's in Rolling, North Carolina. Skip, welcome.
From Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you for taking my call. Two really quick points. I don't think that the question is so much, was Jesse Helms a bigot, as how willing was he, as compared to those other guys you were talking about, to manipulate the bigoted attitudes of others? And connected to that, I'd like to connect this to the previous segment that you had. I think Jesse Helms was responsible for accelerating, if not starting, a lot of this big sort. I think quite a few of the problems that we have in politics nowadays can be traced right back to him and the National Congressional Club.
John Fund, the big sort that Skip is referring to is a book about how Americans are clustering into like-minded communities. Was Jesse Helms somebody who may have exacerbated that or hastened that movement?
I think lots of people can say that they contributed to that. The radicals of the 1960s, people like Helms. I have talked to liberal political consultants who unfortunately won't be publicly identified who say they looked at Helms's mastery of new technology and his ability to use simple, vivid, dramatic language to stir up his base, and they used it as a model for things like MoveOn.org and a lot of the liberal blog sites that went after Joe Lieberman. And I can tell you, the campaign against Joe Lieberman certainly wasn't designed to unite people. It was designed to divide them.
Skip, thanks so much for your call. Thank you. And you mentioned as well, Jesse Helms sort of set the model for Democratic members of Congress to sort of second-guess the State Department, especially under the Bush administration, sending their own teams of advisors to reevaluate foreign policy decisions taken by the Bush administration, taking a page out of Jesse Helms' own playbook.
Well, look, we obviously know the Bush administration made mistakes in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Congress eventually, although with some delay, kicked in its oversight capacity and started sending an awful lot of staffers and people over there, figuring out how much money was being wasted, how much the administration was perhaps being fully revealing about the state of security there, and basically second-guessing developing a shadow Plan B-type foreign policy. Helms started that when he sent people down to investigate whether or not the Contras should get funding, which the Congress was opposing. He would also second-guess the Reagan administration often when they were supporting regimes that he didn't think deserved foreign aid. So Helms started that practice, and I can assure you, if John McCain is elected in November, I can guarantee you the liberal Democrats in Congress are going to be second-guessing a lot of the McCain foreign policy, and maybe they should. We need oversight.
In our remaining moments, let's take one more call. Dan, you're on the air. Dan is in Ela, North Carolina. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Elon, E-L-O-N.
E-L-O-N.
Yes, I grew up in North Carolina, and we are still living with the legacy of Jesse Helms, who, I would remind you, never won by a very large margin in North Carolina.
Never by more than 5 points.
Right. He was never...
Actually, I can correct that. He won his 1978 race by over 10 points.
Thanks for the correction.
Well, I think a good point to be made here is that you cannot justify Senator Helms' racism by using the racism of others.
No, but I'm simply saying when somebody dies, usually the practice is to put their life in full context. You go back to the obituaries of William Fulbright, Al Gore Sr., and Sam Ervin, who was Senator Helms' colleague in North Carolina, who was the leading strategist of the Southern Manifesto in favor of segregation. Go back and see how far down in the paragraphs you have to go to find any reference to their stand on civil rights. I challenge you to go to their obituaries and see how much of that issue it played in the context of their obituaries. That's my point.
But I would challenge you to sort of to find any other accomplishment that Helms was known for.
I just gave them at the beginning. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the most successful bipartisan chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee since the 1940s. His campaign against Zimbabwe, the genocide in Zimbabwe. You go on and on to expanding NATO, which now has over 20 countries. He was largely responsible for that. You go on to many things such as establishing standards of decency for the National Endowment for Humanities and Arts, which you may not agree with, but a lot of taxpayers felt they shouldn't fund stuff that they felt was morally offensive, like Piss Christ.
Dan, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
By the way, when Robert Byrd dies, I can guarantee you that his membership in the Ku Klux Klan and his stands on civil rights in the 1960s and 1970s will not be in the first paragraph of his obituary.
But surely they'll be mentioned. As I say, surely they'll be mentioned, John Fund.
Tell me, I will make you a bet that it's below the 20th paragraph.
Well, we'll have to check back when that happens. John Fund is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us today by phone from Aspen, Colorado. You can find a link to his remembrance of Senator Jesse Helms on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. John Fund, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Tomorrow, age and presidential politics. When is old too old? This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz here in Washington.